Welcome, everyone.
Welcome.
You're going to need a bigger bottle.
You keep finding new ways to step on my welcome.
Yeah, and I also fucked up the name of our podcast. It's you're gonna need a bigger bottle, not you're going to need a bigger bottle.
All right, let's just scrap it. Let's start over. New intro. Begin again.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
God, fuck. And now I was going to say you're welcome. You're welcome, everyone. You're welcome for this podcast. God damn it. Oh, my God.
This intro is the worst. We're just rolling with it. It's a podcast about movies and wine.
It's a podcast about movies and wine, Jamie.
Although this particular episode, mostly about wine.
That is true. And last particular episode, mostly about movies, singular.
Correct. For those of you out there who don't know shit about one or both of these topics, I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I am Scott. I am the movie guy. And we, James and I, are here to help you know how to speak sentences in a way that is tonally communicative to audiences for what you're trying to say. I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. And we're here to help. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We'll tell you and each other why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we don't.
Oftentimes we don't. Frequently,
I think today we may have found one.
Spoilers. I think today you miraculously may have found one, Jamie. Today we are continuing with our lighthearted No Bombers miniseries. Oh, I get to say it today. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I want wine. That's right. So last week we wrapped up the movie section of this miniseries talking about the granddaddy of all 21st century action cinema, Mad Max Goddamn Motherfucking Fury Road. Today, we are talking about what Jamie has paired with that. Jamie, why don't you tell us a little bit about this funky brown liquor that is in a jelly jar right now in front of me?
It's in a jelly jar?
Yeah, that's right. I'm drinking it out of a jelly
jar.
We've
discussed this before. I am very pro drinking wine out of jelly jars.
Well, it just felt appropriate to me, you know, because like if Max and Furiosa are going to find a bottle of this weird shit and crack it open, like they're not getting out flutes or, you know, big mouth red wine glasses. They're going to crack out whatever they can find.
That is absolutely true.
It's probably going to be like a caved in human skull that they bleached in the sun.
Which honestly, I think, you know, that would be an appropriate vessel for this wine.
Do you think so?
I think so.
Well, anyway, it's weird and it's in a jelly jar. Tell me about the wine.
I love this wine. And it has so many names. There is so much writing on the front of this bottle.
Yep.
So this is everyone, and I'm going to read through all of the names of this wine. This is Lustau Almathanista, Juan Garcia Jarana, Oloroso Pata de Gallina, 1 of 38. That was a lot.
1 of 38 butts, Jamie. It's from a Solera of 38 butts, matured in Jerez de la Frontera, Spain.
I love that you just glommed onto the word butts.
Jamie, there's a bottle right next to me and it says 38 butts. Like, what am I going to do? Am I going to leave that alone?
Yeah, you shouldn't leave it alone, honestly.
As a parent, it is my responsibility, and increasingly frequently, to tell my kid to stop talking about butts and farts. But as a grown-ass adult with my own fucking podcast, because in the old days, everybody had shows, Jamie, I am allowed to snicker at a label for a fancy wine that says 38 butts on it. butts.
All right, everyone, hold on to your butts. This is going to be a fun episode. So let's break it down. Let's break down that label. Lustau is the name of the producer. This is the company that sells this wine,
but also makes it.
Well, that's complicated.
Oh my God. Okay. We're the first word into the label and it's complicated. Keep going.
So the second word the second word is why it's complicated. Almathanista. So there are three different parts of the production chain in Jerez. There are the people who work the vineyard. There are the people who age the wine. And then there are the people who ship the wine. Lustau, as a whole, does all three. However, the Almathanista series focuses specifically on the people who age the wines. So in this case, Lustau is purchasing wine from a Solera owned by a different company. And that's Juan Garcia Jarana.
So Juan Garcia Jarana has the wine in his Solera, which is purchased by Lustau.
Correct.
And Almathanista is what?
Almathanista is the name of of a company that focuses solely on the aging of wine, not on the production or shipment of it.
Does Juan Garcia Jarana work for Almathanista?
Juan Garcia Jarana is an Almathanista.
I thought it was a company.
Almathanista is the name of a company that does that thing.
And he is one of them.
Correct.
And what does the word mean?
Literally, it translates as storer.
So Juan Garcia Jarana, he works for a company called Almathanista, and he is himself an Almathanista, which means storer of wine.
The company is not called Almathanista.
Okay. I'm getting serious flashbacks to our last Sherry episode.
The company is an Almathanista. Almathanista is a category of companies.
Okay. And Juan Garcia Jarana is one of those.
Correct.
He's a company.
Yes.
It's his company.
It's his company.
Great. Cool. That's 60 seconds of our lives no one's ever getting back.
Well, I'm really very happy about this.
Okay, let's keep going. What is Oloroso? Yes.
Oloroso, literally translated, means aromatic. It's a style of sherry. We talked last time in the Tenet episode, however many ages of men ago that was, about Fino versus Oloroso. Fino being biologically aged and Oloroso being oxidatively aged. So Oloroso does not get aged under flor, F-L-O-R, which is that yeast film that covers the wine and protects it from oxygen ingress while also reducing the glycerin content of that wine. Oloroso is the other way where the wine is just exposed to oxygen during its aging.
Okay. And then remind me, I don't want to go hog wild on the Solera again, but what are the butts, the 38 butts that this is coming from? This is one of 38 butts.
The question is, what is a Solera?
No.
Or are you asking?
No, just what are the butts?
Butts is the term for casks in Jerez.
Ah, okay. So these are the casks that are part of the Solera system.
Correct. And there are 38 of them, and one of them gets emptied each time they bottle a wine.
Right. The one that gets emptied is the last one in the Solera chain.
Correct.
From cask to cask to cask. So this is from the final butt.
Right.
Okay.
As friend of the pod, Pri, put it, the Solera is the human centipede of wine.
Oh, I forgot about that. Pri is very sharp. That's an extremely good joke.
It's a good joke, and it is made even better by them calling casks butts.
Yeah. Pri, that joke is the gift that keeps on giving. Thank you so much for that.
So the next word on this bottle that I said is pata de gallina, and that literally translated means foot of the chicken, and that's just what this Solera is called. I do not know why.
So the Solera, which is comprised of 38 butts, is called foot of the chicken.
Yep.
And you don't know why?
I do not.
Does anyone know why?
I'm sure the cellar master at Juan Garcia Jarana does.
All right. Let's call him and we can conference him in on this call.
Sure. Do you speak Spanish?
No. No.
So that's going to be a challenge.
All right. Never mind. We won't call him.
So we made it through introducing the wine.
I think we made it through reading the label.
That is true. And we read the label.
I'm glad that we made it. I wasn't sure if we had. So we have finished the label. Wonderful. Oh, shit. There's a whole nother label on the back. There's two more labels?
Yeah, there are.
Jamie, these guys are label happy.
They give you a lot of information, which I appreciate.
You know what? I appreciate that, too. This is one that, had I read the label prior, which I definitely did, I would not be able to. Ooh, and I like their barcode, too. Look at this barcode.
It's got a little bottle silhouette in it.
This is good design. People of Lustau.
They make good wines too. I like the Lustau wines. But particularly, like the Almathanista series is, you know, much smaller production, more sort of intimate winemaking. This is one of 38 butts, right? It's Lustau, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the larger producers in Jerez. So some of their stuff, while still delicious, can feel a little bit impersonal. And I think this is pretty unique among their lines of wines.
When I don't want to get into questioning the minutia of your vocabulary choices, you know, so early in the episode, but
go on ahead. Why don't just let's break that seal.
When you say personal, is that like a euphemism for specific? It's not like you're sitting down to drink a bottle of wine and you can be like, oh, this is such a personal experience. I can really taste the vintner in it. Like, I mean, I guess you would say some shit like that.
Well, but that person is doing something specific. So, right. I mean, I don't think it's a euphemism, but you could think of it as specific. I choose to say personal.
I don't know. It feels euphemistic to me. But okay, so we're on the same page.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, we are. This is an extremely specific wine.
Yes, it is. Spoilers, but I had an awful lot of fun drinking this while watching Fury Road last night.
So this episode is long delayed in the recording, listener at home. We were supposed to record back in December, and then between holidays and Omicron and God knows how many other things going on, we just ended up pushing
and
it
also
off.
The like several panic attacks that Scott and I suffer each day.
Jamie, don't put your label on me. All right, you have panic attacks. I have, you know, little indefinable nervous breakdowns once in a while. But
potato, potato.
We were delayed, and now we're here with this wine. But yeah, I drank. Tani and I split a bottle of this back in December when we thought we were going to be recording, like right before Christmas. And I watched the movie and had a glorious experience with it, as I always do with Mad Max. And I had read a book about the movie, and I drank the wine, and she and I had a lot of good conversations about it. And then I sat down earlier this week to get ready for this recording, and I was like, well, I know I have to watch Fury Road again, which is like a fucking gift. Thank you, past me, for deciding you needed to watch Fury Road again in a month. But then I looked at all of my notes that I had amassed from my previous viewing and reading and drinking of the wine and thinking about it. And Jamie, I wrote fuck all down.
Wow.
I had nothing. Like, I basically had to start from scratch this week in prepping for this episode. And I'm annoyed but not surprised that past Scott just didn't write any of it down.
So Scott, James, since you have written down notes now.
I have them.
Even though, like, past Scott fucked up, present Scott is here with us now and has notes. Give me your notes, give me your takes. What do you think?
Boy, so I mean, if you hadn't previously listened to our two-parter on Tenet and Fino Sherry, then just for context for everybody listening at home, I fucking hated that with a great and profound passion. And I hated it more because Jamie was amused by how much I hated it. I hate drank two bottles of it and really greatly disliked it. And I was very much prepared to do the same thing with this one, in part because I was mad at you for picking Sherry with, you know, one of my all time favorite movies. I thought you were just being a dick. And I don't know if I like this. I don't know if I like it, but I find it fascinating. So on the nose, I'm getting like strong on the raisins right up front. Raisins, brown sugar. I was getting something in the ballpark of baklava. And I don't know which of the like many notes in baklava I'm picking up, but there maybe it's almond or I don't know. It smells like
honey and pistachio are for sure notes that I have written down for this wine.
Yeah.
And those are the flavor components of baklava. Yeah. Along with a little cardamom.
A little cardamom. I was also getting, and this might just be me being suggestible based on the color of the thing and also the association with a movie about cars and guzzling go fast, but there is a hint of something on the nose that reminds me of gasoline.
I don't want to like assume what you're smelling, but for me, that's just the volatile alcohol because this is a fortified wine. This is 20% alcohol. So you can just smell the ethanol on this wine. I don't quite get gasoline, but you know, if you think it's gasoline, that's cool.
In the ballpark, but I think that's fine. If you're saying it's ethanol, that makes sense. Those are smells that are in the vicinity of engines.
I'd prefer that you pronounce it guzzling, though.
Well, but guzzling and gasoline aren't the same thing, Jamie.
I guess that's right.
Well, if you had read the, you know, deep well of lore that's provided to all Mad Max Fury Road fans, then you would know that the great history of guzzling, it was actually created in the early days of the 21st
century. You better fucking stop it.
Yeah, I'm just making all this shit up. It's a word they used because it sounded good, and it was a way for Immortan Joe to put his fucking trademark stamp on it.
Guzzling and Aquacola.
Guzzling, Aquacola. Kama Crazy Fukushima War Boys.
Oh my God. Kama Crazy Fukushima War Boys.
It's all branding, baby. It's just about branding.
They didn't have a crazy name for bullets, though. It was just bullets, right?
Yeah, but they're farmed by the bullet farmer at the bullet farm. Like, I feel like that's enough.
I guess you're right.
Yeah. If there were any justice in the Oscars, Charlize Theron would have been nominated for best actor or best actress. I have started just using the word actor generally, and to like not use a
gender neutral. I think that's appropriate.
It just feels better. But anyway, Charlize Theron would have been nominated best actress for Fury Road, and her Oscar clip would have been the bit where she's looking out the window, and or when Max is like, "Look behind you, we've got company," and she looks over and it's the bullet farmer from the bullet farm. That she is able to sell that absurd and stupid line so beautifully. She's great. Anyway, I digress.
Yes.
I have to include a note from my child who did try to tell us that there was regular old wine smell, but we're like, no, come on. You're trying to get a laugh, but like, what do you really smell? And he had a very astute observation. He was getting notes of sweet coffee on the nose.
Yeah, there's something almost like vanilla latte
about this wine.
Like Starbucks vanilla latte.
Yeah, with like, yeah, they have like a fucking pump bottle that just squirts flavored syrups into it.
Exactly.
And then the flavor is like, this shit is buck wild. So what is the first intense note that I'm hitting? Like, if we want to talk about the, do you guys have a word for like the chronology of a flavor, like the first notes to the finish, like, is there a word for that arc?
Front, mid, and back palate.
Oh, that's very useful. Thank you. So on the front, there is a crazy intense note, and I can't tell if it's like, is it just the super high alcohol? Is that the thing that I'm getting first?
It might be. So the thing that I perceive first is this, like, black walnut flavor that isn't necessarily, like, you get more of the confectionery nuts on the nose, and then this like intense bitter black walnut thing is the first thing that I get. For you, I wouldn't be surprised if the alcohol really fucking jumped out.
Yeah,
because for, you know, I've drunk a number of Oloroso sherries, and I'm expecting to be dealing with higher alcohol, so it's a little bit like I compartmentalize that. Yeah, it could be the acidity, because you're kind of, this wine plays with your expectations a little bit, because you smell it and it's confectionery and brown sugar and maple syrup and caramelized honey, and then it is bone fucking dry.
Okay, so I didn't even bother with Madeline's charts, because whatever baseline of comfort and familiarity I have with, or that I have accumulated with wines over the last, you know, year and a half, does not apply to sherry at all. So this is dry, and yep, it's high acid, and it's high alcohol.
Correct.
I thought acid and alcohol were like on a seesaw and they balanced each other out. Or is that acid and tannin?
Acid and sugar balance each other out.
Okay. So it's high alcohol, it's high acid. Yeah, I don't know. It could be one of those things, but it, like, that intense first note that I'm getting on the front is like, I feel like it's obscuring flavor for a while. Like, I feel like there's stuff I'm not getting because I'm so blinded by whether it's alcohol or acid or something else. But then the journey of it, like, it becomes very funky. There's almost like a tang. And then I'm getting brown sugar towards the end, and then a sourness on the finish.
I think that funky thing that you're talking about is the black walnut thing that I'm talking about. It's almost textural. It almost feels a little bit tannic, but it's definitely like weird and unfamiliar.
Very. When you say black walnut, are you talking about the nut, or I don't know, are you talking about like eating the bark of a black walnut tree? Like, I can never tell with you people.
That is fair.
Perfectly fair.
No, I'm talking about the fruit of the black walnut tree, a black walnut, which is not a flavor that a lot of people are very well acquainted with.
Yeah, I mean, I have never, I don't think, eaten a black walnut. What does it taste like? And don't tell me a black walnut, please, please, please.
I got you.
No, here it comes, drum roll. And
I'm not doing it,
not
Scott.
To be glib,
I'm going to give you a genuine answer here. Okay. And, you know, sometimes the glib response is appropriate, because fucking an unripe mango tastes like an unripe mango. Like, there are things that are kind of elemental.
You could try a little harder, Jamie. You could try a little harder.
But then we wouldn't have our trademark banter.
Yeah, that is true.
So a black walnut is, you've definitely seen the trees around. They are, they're native to this area. When the fruit drops, it's a really thick husk around the nut that is actually green. And when it drops onto the ground, the outside is pretty toxic, so any grass around it dies.
Huh.
One of the reasons why they're not eaten that frequently, especially today, as they are notoriously difficult to get into. Like, even if you have a hammer, it's hard to get to the meat of a black walnut. They're astringent. They're high in fat. They're a little bit like, I would describe the flavor as a little ashy. It feels like even in its raw form, it's a little bit like there's a burned or singed kind of note to it.
And is this a thing that people eat for enjoyment?
It's a thing that exists in like baked goods that sometimes is infused into alcohol. It's not a thing that people eat raw or even just toasted.
Okay. Well, that was a very detailed description. I don't know if that is the funky note that I'm tasting, but okay. Black walnut. Yeah, I don't know, man. This shit's weird. This is super weird. I don't know if I like it, but I find it compelling. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense.
I continue to drink it. I don't hate it the way I hated the Fino Sherry.
I think if you continue to drink Oloroso Sherries and like sort of wrap your head around, like have an expectation of what it's going to be and then experience like some different ones and how they can be different, I feel like you might come around. But also, you know, maybe not. I know that I thought that this was the best chance of getting you to like a sherry without going into like the dessert wines of Jerez.
Although we could do that. And that sounds good because I like dessert.
Yes, I like dessert too. And for sure, we will at some point delve into sweet wine, like actual super sweet wine. That might be a new miniseries.
Oh, it's so weird.
It's bizarre.
It's very strange.
I love it. I absolutely, like, I can't get enough of it. I wish I had more in my house. For me, it's so aromatically intense. And the textural experience of it all is really extremely pleasant. Like, I can understand why someone wouldn't love Fino Sherry, especially because it's so, the flavors are so foreign. This one is all like baking spices and molasses and honey, and it gives you all kinds of sweet flavor notes without having any sugar in it, and that I find to be pleasant.
It is. I won't go as far as pleasant, but it is interesting that there are so many sweet flavor notes sans sweetness. I find it to be a fascinating, compelling object that I am not repulsed by, and I think that's as far as I want to go with the positive things about this wine.
Okay. Duly noted.
I'm not hate drinking it. It's like, I don't know.
You're actually like, you want to figure it out.
Yeah. I'm trying to unpack the thing. And then, I don't know, maybe through unpacking it, I'll achieve some greater appreciation for it.
That was kind of my second watch of The Rider.
I mean, that happens a lot where you'll find something and it gets its hooks into you and then, oh, but I don't like it the way other people do, or I don't understand it the way other people do, or I can't explain why I'm compelled by it, and I'll just keep revisiting something over and over again.
Yeah, that itch that like, I have to understand this thing. And sometimes for sure it can be from outside. Like I have to understand why people like this. And sometimes I feel like even if I had independently come to The Rider, I would have watched it a second time because it's so obvious that there's so much there, right, despite the fact that I found it objectionable.
Yeah.
I mean, I could talk about my takes on this wine. I fucking love it. I love sherry. I'll drink it all day long if you allow me to. But I have to exist in society, which means I'm not allowed to always be drunk. And that sucks for me.
You know what, though, Jamie? You're trying. You're really trying to break down that barrier. I have often said that I think that, you know, if this is not me transitioning to optimism, if we survive the, you know, coming Aquacola Cola Wars, I have long felt that the next great progressive cause will be animal rights, and in particular, like a widespread popularity of vegetarianism, if not full on veganism. And that I feel like is going to be the next moral hurdle that like my child is going to look at me and be like, oh my God, I can't believe you used to eat meat and you used to feed it to me. And I'll be like all these parents now who are like, what do you mean you want to use the other person's bathroom? Like, and it's just going to be me like wishing I had a chicken sandwich. But I think for you, maybe the barrier that you want to break down is just, you know, normalizing constant drunkenness in a professional and personal setting. It was a lot of runway there.
Just like the guys in another round.
Exactly, Jamie. I almost got you, I this is actually true. I almost got you a BAC meter as a gift for Christmas this year. I saw one. It was supposed to be very nice. It had all kinds of, but I just, yeah, I opted not to.
I love what you got me instead. I would absolutely have loved that.
Well, and you
that
would have gotten a lot of use out of it. I wanted to get you something you would enjoy, not just something that you would find practical.
But my Laura Dern t-shirt is my favorite t-shirt.
Oh, buddy. She's your girl right there.
It's motherfucking Laura Dern out here. It's a great t-shirt.
Space Dern, no less.
Says her name on it.
Space Dern.
Starfield.
Pew, pew, pew.
Yeah, I don't actually have any hopes of breaking down the stigmas around public drunkenness, although I would love to break down some of the stigma that Americans specifically have around drinking alcohol at all. And like developing a culture where, you know, the first time that people are introduced to alcohol isn't in college through binge drinking. Like, it'd be cool if parents taught their children how to respect the damn thing.
Right.
And soapbox.
And endeth the soapbox.
This particular soapbox.
Well, I can't disagree with that. Yeah. The catch is, by the time someone is legally allowed to drink, they want fuck all to do with their parents in a, you know, social or party setting.
Yeah, that is also true.
Looking forward to it. 16 years, baby.
So one of the things that I think is fascinating about sherry is how incredibly process driven it is. It makes it stand out in the world of wine, especially the current world of wine, where everyone's talking about the specificity of place and about the terroir of a given place. And we don't have to get into that particular thing right now. But also, like, most winemakers will say something to the effect of, I just try and shepherd the wine along in its fermentation and stay out of its way, or make wine in a non-interventionist way. Sherry is entirely not that. Sherry is fundamentally a process. Sherry, you know, begins in the vineyards like any other wine. And, you know, we talk about the specific vineyards and how the farming gets done and all of that. But then it gets harvested and fermented and aged for a phenomenally long period of time, during which just about every day a cellar master called a capataz comes around and tastes all these wines to make sure that they are following the aging path that they are hoping for. So if it's a particularly, you know, fine and mineral driven wine, then it's tasted for that characteristic. And if it sort of begins to lean a different way, it gets reclassified. A wine that starts its life headed towards fino, if maybe the floor in that barrel dies, it can continue as an oxidative wine, and we'd call that Amontillado. You've got fino and Oloroso on either side of the spectrum, and in between are Amontillado and Palo Cortado. Amontillado being where the floor dies of its own volition, the Palo Cortado being where the capataz detects something in the character of the wine that he or she regards as leaning a little bit more oxidative. And at that point, they will fortify the wine to kill the floor and then age it oxidatively for the rest of its life until bottling.
How do they fortify it? Is that just the addition of alcohol?
That's the addition of brandy.
Mm, I mean, that sounds pretty good already. Make a little cocktail with this stuff and some brandy. It's already tasting better.
Well, what's in your glass is fortified.
So this has brandy in it?
Yes.
That's what fortification is the addition of brandy.
Very few yeast strains can achieve 20% of alcohol on their own. Any wine that you see that has like above 18% alcohol is probably fortified. And yeah, it's the addition of brandy. And specifically in Jerez, it has to be brandy that is made from sherry, from Jerez wine.
So let me see if I understand what you're talking about. That you're saying that this capataz person, that they're going around and like tasting and checking and seeing how the various butts in the Solera are evolving. But like, do they not start out at the beginning saying we want to make a fino or we want to make an Oloroso? Or is it just like watching the process evolve and then making modifications and decisions partway through?
It's both of those things.
God damn so it. Why is it always both?
Because this is wine, Scotty.
The world of wine.
That's right. So really what happens is the grapes come in from the harvest, they get fermented, they get barreled down, which just means they get transferred into barrels. And at that point, that is what's called the sobretablis phase. And the capataz will make his or her initial classifications on the wines. And they do this simply by marking the barrel with a piece of chalk. If he marks it with a raya, then that is destined to be a fino, and it gets put into a fino solera. If it is dos rayas, that is an oloroso. If it's tres rayas, that's likely going to be brandy or vinegar.
Wait, really?
Yes.
So one thing can end up on a spectrum from brandy to vinegar?
Yes.
You don't seem to understand why that's weird for me, because those two things are very, very different.
Yeah, they're very different, but the process of distilling something will take away whatever volatility is there that might make it feasible as a vinegar. So at that point, like, you're looking at the lowest quality juice, and it's just a determination at that point whether it's you know good enough to enter in like a high quality vinegar solera, or if it should just be distilled. Yeah, I know they're two completely different products, but they're both places to put lower quality wine.
This seems like this person has a very difficult job, the capataz.
Yes.
And they're in there tasting every day?
Yep.
And they taste every butt in the solera every day?
No. That would be a lot. Especially at any kind of scale, you maybe would taste the 38 butts of the pata de gallina solera in a day, but then you have however many other soleras going.
Oh, right. Because they have multiple solaring processes happening at once.
Right.
And not only would you not have the time, but you would probably just be pretty drunk, right?
That is correct.
Right. It sounds like a hard job. It sounds like a lot of big decisions to be made about taking one product and deciding based on your experience and expertise that, well, this product could become any of four different products, and I will decide right now. I don't know. It seems difficult. Like, there's a high bar, and there's also a lot of pressure.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a phenomenally, like, if I had the chance to go and train to be a capataz and do that for a living, I would jump at the opportunity. It sounds amazing, but yeah, you're correct. It also sounds really daunting and very high pressure, because you are responsible for a consistent output, especially if you're doing something like the wine that we had during the Tenet episode, the Innocente Fino. That's a massive production on that wine, and every bottle has to taste exactly the same.
Well, I mean, look, some people screw up. Mistakes are made, and someone decided that Innocente Fino had to taste like that. And, you know, this is what I'm saying. There's pressure. Sometimes they don't meet the pressure. No, that's mean. Listen, I don't want to be mean to the people who make that wine just because I don't like it.
It's delicious.
That's a strong word.
I think
word.
It's delicious.
That's a very strong word.
I find it to be delightful. And if I had a bottle right now, I would want to be drinking it.
You would want to be drinking the Fino over this Lustau Oloroso.
Not necessarily. I might have Fino after this, like when we're done recording.
Really? You would chase this with the other type of sherry?
Yeah, why not?
I don't know. Why?
Because I like it, Scott, okay?
Oh, I forgot. Sorry.
You might watch Tenet at any point ever again. I probably won't, because I think that movie is stupid fucking garbage.
Well, so see, this is the thing that I was winding up to, is what terrifies me, and not terrifies me, but you know what? That's interesting. So what I was about to say is what terrifies me is the prospect of drinking that wine again and discovering that I like it. Right? Like, my wine palate vocabulary has expanded, and I've enjoyed the Oloroso, and maybe I'll go back to the Innocente Fino, and maybe I'll actually enjoy it. And then I'll have to go back on what I said before. And as those words are coming out of my mouth, I'm realizing, well, wait, like, I spent much of my adult life as a movie person, like, ridding myself and fighting against the notion that, like, we need to be consistent in our opinions. Like, it's good to go back and re-expose yourself to something and being like, oh man, you know what's great is being wrong.
It's so good. Like, if I did a rewatch of Tenet and I ended up like loving it for some other reason or for, you know, the exact reasons that I hated it, that would be a gain for me because then suddenly there's another thing in the world that I like.
Exactly. It's nice to have more things to like.
Exactly. We are in 100% agreement on this point.
So I'm still going to be a stick in the mud and say that Inocente Fino tastes like gross, nasty butts. Well, wrong butts, other butts. But, in truth, I should give it another shot at some point.
At some point, I will for sure, because I like sherry a lot, have a bottle open when you are in proximity, and you will like it or not. Maybe by the time we're old men, you'll come around. Older men than we already are.
And, you know, maybe by the time the inverted future time war comes back to destroy us all with their inverted bullets and their reverse talking craziness, maybe you'll come around on Tenet.
Maybe I will. I don't, that shit exhausts me.
Tenet.
Oh God. Anyway, I have next thoughts. This wine is a product of the process that is used to make it. There are a lot of arguments to be made and, you know, smarter people than me have made them, that this is also a product of the vineyard and the particular soils and the climate and the winds and all of that. And there's even the climate of the bodegas where the aging occurs that influences the final character of these wines. But for me, the fascinating part is less in the vineyard and more in the bodega. And that's a parallel that you see with champagne. And frequently in the wine world, champagne and sherry are spoken of within the same conversation because they're both wines that spend an awful lot of time in the cellar. They're both wines that are shepherded through their maturity by people who taste every day and make decisions over a long period of time. Most champagne doesn't, you know, release into the market until, you know, many years after the vintage.
Really?
And it is also a non-vintage product usually.
And you're talking about just champagne. You're not talking about sparkling white wine.
Yeah, I'm talking about just champagne, but everything right. that I just said also applies to many sparkling wines the world over.
How long do they stay in the cellar?
It depends on the producer, but legally, I believe it's 36 months on lees prior to release.
Legally. Oh my God. I'm never not going to eye roll when you mention yet another European or specifically French law that dictates how wine should be made.
I also roll my eyes at
it's
that.
Just, you it's are just correct. So dumb, and it's not what law is there for. You know, law is there to define how you are allowed to interact with the state and with other people.
There you are, the preacher. Here I am, the choir.
That is what law is for, Jamie. Stop arguing with me. Law should not be about dictating and, you know, fucking consolidating the French monopoly on sparkling white wine.
Yes, I agree. So I have the answer now.
Wonderful.
Legally, non-vintage champagne has to see a minimum of 15 months from the date of tirage, which means from the date they begin secondary fermentation, and vintage wines, it's 36 months. And that blend gets put together from base wines that can be much older than that. You know, what is a non-vintage, let's say Veuve Clicquot, could contain wines from as far back as 15 years.
Okay. I don't really understand how that's possible, but also we're not talking about champagne today. So
we're not talking about champagne. So the next thing in this parallel is the big difference here, right? Champagne's got prestige. Champagne's got cachet. Champagne's super duper expensive. And there are a lot of copycats the world over. That is not the case with sherry. Sherry is remarkably inexpensive for a product that I think tends to contain some pretty superlative quality, and it is not replicated in very many places in the world. There are a couple of what they call Sauvoir wines in France, which is a Fino type style. There are a handful of adventurous producers in the United States, and there are some deliberately oxidized wines called Rancio made in the Basque Country and Catalonia. It's an interesting dichotomy that exists between these styles. And I think it's, world tastes definitely are the driver of that.
Right. And so that's my question to you then. So like, so, all right, it makes sense that champagne has a lot of imitators because it's an extremely successful and beloved and expensive product. There's money to be made. So is the reason that there aren't sherry knockoffs is because sherry is inexpensive and therefore what? Like there's not as much profit to be made? Like, or is it just about where it's grown? Like, is that the reason why sherry is only coming out of Spain?
I think a big part of it is that sherry, the character of the finished wine, hasn't changed much over the last couple hundred years. It has not changed with palate changes. Champagne has. If we were to have a taste of the first ever Dom Perignon that was produced in the 1400s, it would have been a very sweet, lightly sparkling wine. It's been changed over the years and refined and has driven into a dry wine space based on consumer wants and needs. Sherry has remained what it is. I think a huge part of that is economic depression in the area and also wars in the area, particularly the Peninsular Wars in the 1800s. Also, there's a lot like there's something to be said for culturally the difference between Andalusian people and the people of Northern France.
Oh boy. All right. Let's tread lightly here, Jamie. Let's try not to make some classic Jamie generalizations about people from other places we've never been to.
It is my sense that generally the people of Andalusia are into tradition and what has been and celebrating the past. And the people of Northern France tend to be a little bit, you know, progressive and forward thinking. I'm not making a quality call on either, by the way.
I mean, there's a bit of a value judgment implicit there.
Well, both have problems, right? The progressiveness and forward thinkingness also leads to allowing your product to be steered entirely by the market for money, for capitalist gains. That's bad, and takes a product that in my eyes should be an art form and reduces it to dollars and cents. The other way is just a stubborn adherence to the ways of the past without thinking about what is going on now. And there's good for both too, right? That progressiveness can breed creativity and breathe new life into a region. And that respect for tradition can give you a sense of richness and vibrancy of culture in the area. So I really don't want to seem like I'm making a quality call. It's just two different ways of seeing this.
That makes sense. Eventually on the show, we're going to have to do a champagne, right? Like a champagne.
One of the problems with that is price point.
Right. They're prohibitively expensive.
Yeah, they start at $40.
Right. Which is, I would say, a lot, even for, you know, a product.
It's a lot of money.
It's more than I would want to spend. But, you know, for right. a fancy, I don't know. We'll find an excuse and we'll talk about champagne and then maybe we'll find a way back to talking about sherry on our champagne episode instead.
We for sure will. If we're talking about champagne, I'm probably going to talk about sherry is okay. My point.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
Now. So this shit has just always tasted this way.
Pretty much. Yes.
Fascinating.
You know, it wasn't birthed exactly this way because it takes a long time to make sherry, but yeah, the style is largely unchanged.
Ooh, boy, is that an acquired taste right there.
It sure is.
I have yet to acquire it, but I think I'm in the ballpark of acquiring the taste.
I'm glad that you're not like viscerally hating it the way that you did the Inocente.
Visceral is a good word, though. It is a visceral experience drinking this. Like my mouth and my throat and my mind are all having strong reactions. But not hating, not visceral hatred.
Just strong.
Very strong. Sometimes they're not positive reactions, but they're not hatred. It's provocative. I think it's a provocative wine. Are there provocative wines out there? Is that a word that you would abuse to describe a wine?
I think so, yeah. And I think I would definitely call this one a provocative wine.
It gives me experiences that on the surface are not pleasant and then challenges me not to like them. And I am struggling not to like it. Like I want to not like it, but it's a provocation. It's like, fuck you, drink this. Yeah, it is kind of interesting. Yeah, you do want a little bit more, don't you? It's like in
I think you're assigning a little bit of my personality to this wine.
I think I assign a little bit of your personality to all wines at this point.
That makes me feel so good. Thank you, Scott.
But especially the bad ones.
Still, thank you, Scott.
When I mask up and go to the liquor store and see a bottle of Skinny Bitch, I immediately think of you, Jamie.
Oh, go f*** yourself. Oh, my God. Were you aware at all of the fucking the Oreo wine thing?
No, that sounds terrible.
Yeah, Barefoot paired with...
Of course they did.
Partnered with Oreo, and they made... And I swear to God, it was Oreo Thins flavored Barefoot.
I mean, Oreo Thins rule... We have recently had this argument, and you're stupid and wrong about it. Oreo
double
Thins
stuff
are great.
Is the correct.
No, double
ratio.
Stuff is just like there's too much cum in there, Jamie. Like, I don't want that much cum in my cookie. And also, the actual black chocolate cookie of the Oreo is the least successful part of the cookie. So, if you have less cookie.
How does it
cookie,
feel to be so profoundly wrong about something, Scott?
I don't know, Jamie. I'm going to have another glass of sherry and find out. Anyway, that's gross. Oreo flavored wine?
Oreo flavored wine. I never got to taste it because This is, I swear to God, this is true. It's sold out worldwide in a week.
No. Oh, that's so gross.
Yep.
Oreo flavored wine. Oreos are just getting weird. Everybody's getting weird. Right before Christmas, I was at the grocery store doing, you know, grocery shopping. That's what you do at the grocery store.
Yeah.
Also, you wear your mask and stare fucking laser beams and daggers at every other motherfucker out there who doesn't have a mask on, and you sweat
a lot. I live in Philadelphia. Everyone's wearing a mask here, baby.
Well, come on out to the burbs, Jamie, and do a grocery trip with me where every single time I skip the last 17 items on my list because I just want to leave because I'm tired of hating people and hyperventilating. Anyway, in the like Christmas candy section, they had all of these insane candy cane flavors. Oreo candy canes, Swedish fish candy canes, Nerds candy canes, bunch of other weird, like, just give me a goddamn candy cane. Who other than the people at Big Candy Cane and the Nabisco Company, who was angling for an Oreo candy cane?
Nobody, but I bet they sold a ton of them.
I don't know. The shelves look pretty full. Well, we'll have to do an episode on that wine because now I'm compelled. Just like I'm compelled to keep drinking this sherry that I don't like. I am compelled to find out. Why is it even Oreo Thins? They taste exactly the same as the other ones.
Dude, I don't know. It's all, everything's bad. These are the end times.
These really are the end times. The barefoot Oreos is akin to... Everybody having a multiverse. Let's just take all of our IPs and cram them together and people will buy it and it'll sell out. And in the midst of a pandemic, Spider-Man will be, you know, the fifth highest grossing movie of all time.
I just can't imagine what that wine would even taste like and how you would go about even making. I have a lot of questions that I haven't really even tried to answer because I'm afraid. I'm guessing they made like a syrup that tastes vaguely Oreo-ish and added it to bad wine,
yeah,
and then bottled it.
That would be my guess as well. Oh, God. All right, we can't talk about this anymore. It's been like 10 minutes on the barefoot Oreo wine. I can't do it anymore. Moving on.
We have to move on.
I have a question for you.
Yes. What's your question?
So this is rooted in our agreed specificity. We agree that this wine is extremely specific.
Yes, we do.
I think about this a lot. I think about how things are arrived at. I don't know. In the last year, I've been thinking very like anthropologically, just a lot like thinking about how we arrive at things that people enjoy. You know, like how language and how foods and how things are discovered, you know, and like who was the first person the first caveman who happened to be crossing through a fucking field of, I don't know, like coca plants, like during a lightning storm, and then suddenly he woke up 3 days later and his heart was fucking pounding like crazy. Like how things are arrived about, how we discover.
How did the first person discover that oysters were edible, and why did they even try to eat this like snot looking thing out of a shell?
How desperate must you be that you have to first forge a knife and then carve open what looks like a rock out of the ocean and then you're gonna eat some gray boogers out of it? Like how desperate we must be to achieve these things.
Yes.
How did this specific wine come to be? Like, I'm not even to say that it's like to bring my own biases of how I find it maybe unappealing and weird and provocative, but like, just when did sherry happen and who thought this up? Because it's so specific, right? Like, yep. And you're saying there's a huge process. So like the process took forever. That must have taken for fucking ever to iterate. Like, where did this shit come from?
You're going to love my short answer.
You can just say it. Go ahead. I know what it is.
It's colonialism.
I might have to bleep that, but okay. We don't say the C word on this show, Jamie.
I didn't say the C word.
You said colonialism.
Yes, I did. We do say colonialism on the show because it's basically the root of everything that's bad in today's society, but also in this case, something that's kind of good, I guess.
In the world of wine.
The longer answer is wine has been recorded having been made in Andalusia in the Jerez area since around 1100 AD. Question mark on what the character of that wine was, but my guess is that by the time of the 15th century, it had arrived at something resembling this.
So you're thinking about 400 years? No, 300 years.
Give or take. But the 15th century is where it gets interesting. There was a noted long-running war during that time called the Hundred Years' War between England and France. The English have always sort of had a taste for French wine, and it's very easy to ship wine from France to England.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a longer route overseas from the southern tip of Spain to the British Isles. So one of the reasons why this was so appreciated by the British market is that it was durable for the trip across the sea. It was fortified, sometimes already oxidized. It made it from point A to point B, tasting like it should.
And that's why?
Well, during the Hundred Years' War, obviously the English aren't drinking French wine, so they're looking elsewhere for the wine that they want to drink. They find port. This is also during a time where the British are developing a taste for sugar, like in their food, in their beverages as well. So sweet wines became much, much more prevalent. And then they also found sherry. And while they didn't conquer Portugal or Spain, they purchased an awful lot of property. And by being landowners, were able to influence the local wine laws and build up a lot of economic power. And this is sort of the beginning of what we might call colonialism by capitalist means, maybe. This is the British doing bad things to people who don't have a lot of money.
Because they had more boats than everyone else, and they thought they could.
And not only did they think they could, they could. They did.
The sun will never set on the British Empire. Flash forward several hundred years later.
Yeah, I mean, that's how this product gets arrived at. You know, it remained largely unchanged. You know, I mentioned that there's a tradition in the area for this type of wine, but also there was a huge war between a number of different factions on the Iberian Peninsula that sort of economically decimated, particularly the southern part of Spain, which meant that there wasn't a lot of wine being produced during the 19th century, which was a time when, to call back to Champagne, Champagne was doing a lot of innovation in their production methods. There was better glass around. They could have finer bubbles, longer time aged in the bottle, and a trend towards drier products. All of that innovation sort of didn't happen. And the modern revitalization of sherry didn't start until the late 19th century and really has only begun in the modern era in the late 20th century.
Because of Fraser and Niles.
That's right. Fraser and Niles did it.
Hey, man.
Really, it's New York bartenders, but, you know, potato, potato.
Jamie, who's more influential, New York bartenders or 12 seasons and, I don't know, 100 Emmys of Dr. Fraser Crane, who, by the way, is coming back, baby.
As Fraser Crane?
He's coming back for, I don't know, one of the fucking streaming services that will exist for another 18 months before another huge merger.
Sounds great.
Fraser, he's coming back.
Gonna love it.
So he's gonna just blow sherry up all over again.
I love that.
Wait, do you actually think that there's an argument to be made that New York bartenders are more influential than a television show that was seen by tens of millions of people?
Yep.
I guess it depends on what we're talking about them influencing.
Well, they influence other bartenders who then influence millions of other people who sit at their bars.
I don't know. I feel like, you know, 30 million people tuning in for the series finale of Frasier has more Like, this isn't even like a visual media versus wine thing. This is just like, just in terms
this
of
is just numbers.
Number of people being influenced. I would think.
So let's talk about like the most influential or one of the most influential bartenders is Jim Meehan.
Wait, you're going to drill down to one person?
Yeah.
All right, fine. Jim Meehan versus Frasier. Frasier wins. TKO.
Listen, Jim Meehan wrote a book called the PDT Cocktail Book, which has been behind every bar that I've ever worked. It has sold millions of copies worldwide. It has influenced millions of bartenders. And each of those bartenders who puts cocktails on their list are at the very least influenced by the technique and the style that Meehan brings to his particular drinks. And they deliver that influence to the masses. The masses might not know about Jim Meehan, but they have drunk a cocktail that was influenced by him.
You make a compelling argument, but I feel like it's not New York bartenders versus Frasier, it's book versus Frasier.
Well, that book came out of a time when there were a number of New York bartenders who were exploring and bringing in new products, and that doesn't happen in a vacuum. It didn't just happen at PDT. It happened in conversation with other bartenders.
And they were all down on sherry cocktails.
Yes, indeed.
You have yet to make me a sherry cocktail. You threatened, I believe, 8 months ago when we recorded our Inothente Fino episode. You threatened to make me sherry cocktails. And in the brief window of time when I allowed myself to go out and also have people into my home, you know, before Omega Gomicon, there were no sherry cocktails made for me.
That's fair. That's a personal failing on my part.
It's a huge
and I want
personal
to deeply
and
apologize,
professional failing.
Not just to you, but to our listeners worldwide.
You're just trying to make up for a recent episode in which you said, fuck the audience, right? This is just your mea culpa for saying, fuck the audience not long ago.
No, also fuck the audience, but I'm sorry.
Wow. Wow. All right. So I'm done talking about Frasier. I'm done talking about one New York bartender. You make a compelling argument. Okay. Okay, fine.
Yeah. And I don't even think we need to put a cap on the how sherry ends up tasting like this thing. Like it. We hit all the points we needed to hit. It's time for wife takes.
I actually don't know that we did hit all the points that we needed to hit. I wasn't going to break, but like you told me, I asked you how sherry came to be, and you told me how sherry came to be popular in England and therefore the rest of the world.
Do I need to explain the global influence of the British Empire?
No, but I asked you how this came to be, and you told me how it was popularized. I'm saying how did someone discover
okay,
the process
okay.
that led to this weird flavor thing?
I mean, I did. Like it's durable. That's the big thing.
No, but it already existed, right? Like it's not like the British got there and they were like, people of Spain, we can't get French wine. Make us sherry. It must be 20% and taste like butts. Like
that, no.
The sherry was already there. So before the British, how did the sherry get involved? Jamie, your mind has been colonized, buddy. All you can think about it, your Anglo-centric point of view. You're trading in your Jamie-centric worldview for an Anglo-centric worldview.
Well, I mean, some of it is for sure. I can't tell you whose idea it was to put wine into a Solera and make sherry for the first time. But when the British arrived, something like this already existed, and it became further codified and specified by its necessity of travel, and then also by the palate of the British Empire.
Okay, so you're just not going to answer the question then, is what we've arrived at.
I don't have an answer for the question.
All right, there we go. I will now that you admit, I will go, and later on I will record a new version of the question to put earlier in the show. And I will ask, Jamie, how did sherry come to be codified and cemented on the global stage? And then your answer will match perfectly.
Well, I mean,
to
you asked, how did this get arrived at? And I told,
yeah, I didn't mean geographically. How did someone get to it? Like, it's just like a fundamental misreading of the question, I feel like. Maybe I didn't phrase it very well. That is very possible.
I also don't think that I don't think that you really can answer the question of like how a fermented product exactly ends up being what it is.
Right, without time travel.
And part of it is like the particularities of the fermentation. And then like that particular person being like, this tastes interesting. What if I put it into a barrel? what if it got fractionally blended? The fractional blending is also a result of British influence and the need for free flowing capital, which just means that the product needs to be the same each time. But the first time that sherry tasted like pata de gallina oloroso, I don't know. I don't have an answer for you.
We don't have all right. So here's a weird, totally not wine related example. Dogs, the domestication of wolves into dogs, right? Like, we have a pretty solid theory for how that happened.
Yeah.
Without actually anyone being present tens of thousands of years ago when the first wolves started lingering around, early human camps and fires, and they were just basically hanging out hoping to get scraps, and then nature and natural selection allowed that the cuter ones would do better, and then cuter and cuter and cuter and friendlier, and then the domestication of dogs. We can figure that out. That's reasonable. That makes a lot of sense, and there's scientific evidence to back it up.
Right.
Is there anywhere in the timeline of the development of wine where wine historians will say, well, this offshoot, sherry really came about because there was a shortage in this place, and then the development of this was because the Spanish had a particular kind of wood? There's no theories like that for the origin of sherry?
There is that specifically, but that's not even what you're asking. That question, because of wood or there was a shortage somewhere, is more akin to what I'm answering. You're asking where did the idea for a beverage that tastes like this come from? And in the way that there's a fossil record of dogs through the ages, there just isn't with wine. Wine gets drunk or evaporated. So what we have is the written record and the vessels that get left over. And in some cases, especially places where conflict is common, the written record is extremely broken. We're in one of those places right now in Andalusia.
All right. I'm not going to press you any further.
Let me attempt an answer that satisfies perhaps the both of us. A beverage that tastes like this is an amalgam of the obscure history of Jerez from 1100 until the 15th century, the necessity of a stable product to be shipped across the seas, and the market forces of the British palate specifically, which then became codified and traditionalized in Jerez.
All right. That feels like a concise, comprehensive answer that I accept gladly. Thank you.
Is it time for wife takes?
It may well be wife takes time. Time for wife takes.
Are we going to talk about how I'm going to die in the apocalypse again?
Oh, yeah. See, because we're not doing the movie side this time. I always get a little bit sad, but then I realize that there's still a chance to talk about the post-apocalyptic scenario of these movies because the gift of wife takes. So this is the classic podcast game and created by my wife, Tani, to recreate her favorite way to antagonize Jamie when we would visit him at his restaurants. She would come up with pretentious and flowery descriptions of the wines to match the highest heights of pretension achieved by Jamie and his Somme ilk. And it would always drive him crazy. And it brings me great joy and delight to bring that back to life. So for this miniseries, we're taking a bit of a left turn. And instead of Tani making jokes about the wine, she's making jokes about our specific end of the world scenario that we are discussing. So, James, all of these questions will pertain to the Mad Max Fury Road apocalypse, ride me to Valhalla, shiny and chrome of the wasteland of glory.
I'm so excited.
All right. So, question number one, and yes, you've already guessed it. How do you, Jamie, ultimately die on the Fury Road? A.
I don't get on the fucking Fury Road.
And that's how you die? So is your answer killed in nuclear wasteland?
I mean, if we're going to fit with the theme of my answers for the other post-apocalyptic scenarios, which tends to be I die first, yeah.
A, venomous snake bite. B, poisonous snake bite. C, eaten by animals. D, eaten by cannibals.
The only one of these scenarios that's plausible in this world is eaten by cannibals. You basically don't see snakes anywhere. There are no snakes that are poisonous. They're all venomous. Thank you very much, Tani. I know that.
Yeah. She was giving you a little freebie there.
And there are basically no animals that we see.
What about the two-headed lizard?
who himself gets eaten.
Well, I don't think that's his fault. Like, he's just lower on the food chain.
He's not going to eat me.
Max is an apex predator.
He's too small.
Yeah, he's not going to eat you. That's true. See, I thought the answer would have been Jamie gets bitten by, which one is right? Venomous and poisonous?
Venomous.
Jamie gets bitten by a snake and someone says, I'm going to come over and suck the poison out. And then Jamie says, actually, it's venom. And then that person leaves him to die.
See that? Yeah, that makes sense.
That feels much better. Her answer is, there is no specific right answer. I do think it is telling that she has left out anything that occurred in the movie as any kind of possible thing, because in a Fury Road or a Mad Max type situation, you and also I would never, ever end up in a, you know, having fist fights on the back of tanker trucks while driving fast cars type of scenario.
No, I would be a Morton Joe's like distiller or something. Like I would have carved myself out a niche where like I'm comfortable enough, but definitely still under somebody else's heel, but also just definitely like not in a place where I am in danger of getting into a fight.
You're just like down in the bowels of the Citadel trying to figure out how to cement mother's milk.
Oh my God. That's the grossest thing I've ever heard. Fermented mother's milk.
It's pretty disgusting. All right. Next question. How would you, Jamie, describe this wine? A, shiny. B, chrome. C, shiny and chrome. D, neither shiny nor chrome.
This wine is neither shiny nor chrome.
This wine is neither shiny nor chrome. I completely agree. Yeah. Just like everything in the movie, nothing in the movie except for the spray paint that they put on their mouths right before they suicide bomb themselves, nothing is actually shiny and chrome. Everything is grungy and dirty and brown.
It's kind of wild. I had that thought when Nux was looking back at the convoy coming to get them, and he looks at them and he goes, so shiny, so chrome. My thought was, no, they're fucking not.
Yeah, they're all filthy and gross, dog.
They're beat to shit.
But, you know, he's trying to ascend to shininess and chromeness. You know, it's if you said something was cool, Jamie, I wouldn't come up and be like, actually, it seems like a tepid temperature.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
Yeah. Well, Tani says the answer is definitively C, shiny and chrome, because on the one hand, it makes Jamie feel that he is approaching Valhalla. And on the other hand, it makes Scott want to throw himself into oncoming traffic.
She is the literal worst.
She's so mean. And she has two open-ended questions, which I do think are very funny, although that last one was mean. One of her open-ended questions is, how does the of the Citadel express itself? How does the of a giant rock mountain that sticks up out of the desert like an obelisk that somehow has an enormous like irrigation system to pump water from deep in, out of the earth. How does that reflect flavor?
The Citadel. Okay. So I don't know. The of the Citadel is despair, for sure. But the flavor itself, I imagine that grapes would get very ripe. It's fucking hot and there's a lot of sun, a lot of sun, sandy soils. So, I mean, you could grow Palomino, the grape that is used to make this sherry. It's often grown on sandy soils in a hot, arid climate. I mean, honestly, you could arrive at something like this. It would probably be, if you just made it into a regular ass white wine, it would be fuller in body, higher in alcohol, but also like pretty intensely saline, that like wind-blown, hardened skins kind of thing that happens to grapes. But with a profound sense while you're drinking it of despair, lack of hope, and sadness.
Well, see, but Jamie, this is what we're always talking about. You keep putting bullshit in your descriptions of flavor. You were really onto something legitimate when trying to come up with the of the Fury Road Citadel, and now you're talking about despair. Nobody can taste the despair.
You can taste the despair, Scott.
I mean, I can. I'm going to have some more of this sherry right now. I got one more crossover thing for you that may or may not produce any laughs. This is just me. This is not wife takes, but I'm right now reading Max's tattoo.
It's so good. Yes. The war boys give him.
Well, it's not just the war boys. It's one of the many brilliantly named characters in the movie. Organic Mechanic, who is the one who actually tattoos this on Max's back. And I'm going to read you selections of it. And I want to see if you can come up with what, if you were captured and turned into a blood bag, what they would tattoo on your back. So they've got height 10 hands, 180 pounds. I'm not asking for your height in hands or your weight, but describing his physical condition, no lumps, no bumps, full life clear, two good eyes, no busted limbs, piss okay, genitals intact, multiple scars, heals fast, O negative, high octane, universal donor.
Okay, and what's the question?
What would your tattoo have on your back if you were made into a blood bag? So no lumps, no bumps. You don't have any tumors that we're aware of.
No lumps or bumps. Correct. What's the
full life? You're not a half life, right? You're not irradiated.
I'm probably like 8/10 life.
Eight tenths life. Okay, clear. I don't know what the clear is in reference to. Maybe it's one of his humors. Two good eyes. You have like two okay eyes, right?
My eyes are fine.
They're fine. You have to wear glasses though.
I have to wear glasses, but they're fine.
Did you see any opticians around at the Citadel, Jamie?
No.
Two fine eyes then. No busted limbs. How is your piss, Jamie? Is your piss okay?
My piss is okay.
It's okay. It's fine. Genitals.
Intact.
Intact. Multiple scars, heals fast. I'm assuming you're not really very scarred.
I've got some scars. I wouldn't say multiple scars. I'd say some scars, few scars.
Probably not heals fast though.
Heals slow.
So O negative, what is your blood type?
This is really important
for the internet to listen to.
I really don't know.
High octane, you're definitely not high octane.
I'm not, no. I'm like medium. I'm premium at most.
I think you're that sticker at the gas station that says this gasoline contains no more than 15% ethanol.
Fair. Although sometimes more than 15% ethanol.
Yeah. And lone road warrior rundown on the powder lakes, V8, no guzzling, no supplies, isolate psychotic, keep muzzled. I don't think any of that applies to you except for isolate and keep muzzled.
You don't have to keep me muzzled, man.
No, but then you'll just drink all the sherry.
Yeah, because I like it. I like it a lot.
All right. So I'm done with that. That was silliness. That was funsies. So Jamie, do you think the pairing works with the movie? I think you intimated early on that you do think
it works. Yeah, I do. I think it works.
You think it really works? Great.
I fucking love it. The first thing that you said is that it looks like gasoline or guzzling in the glass, but also just the oxidative, the nutty, raisiny, dried fruit kind of character for me is evocative of like the desert. It's super high alcohol, which you would need in the post-apocalypse. Watching the movie, I just had a ton of fun. It feels like the colors of the flavors that I'm getting from this wine match up with the colors of the movie itself, the color palette of the movie itself.
Really? You're getting like strong, like cyan and orange flavors from this wine?
There's a lot of browns going on in that movie.
Yeah.
The browns and the straw colors and for sure there's a lot of cyan in the movie, but the warmer side of the color palette.
Ooh, because the color palette, like if we're gonna make like a visual comparison, the color palette that this wine evokes for me is not actually from the movie. It's from all of the production stills from the movie.
Okay.
So like the movie obviously has this gorgeous and lush and saturated color palette. And I don't know why. I have never understood this. My assumption was always like a marketing team that didn't know what to do with the movie, even though they put together marvelous trailers. But all of the production stills for this film are very desaturated, very high contrast, and like muddy brown and gray. And they just sucked all the color out of it. And if the wine were to evoke any Fury Road adjacent color palette for me, it would be these just like muddy brown and gray stills that were released and lied about what the movie was going to look like for like a full year leading up to its release.
Yeah, I don't get the gray as much as I get more browns and oranges from the wine. I mean.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of like actual synesthetic connections, I will say like I had more of one with this wine in this movie than I've had in a while on the show. And you're not going to like this, but it very specifically at the beginning of like the last major action set piece when, you know, Furiosa is driving the goddamn war rig right back through the center of enemy territory. And what's his name? Slit Nux's Lancer is now, he's laying on the hood of like a totally, actually kind of shiny and chrome, like redone version of Max's car, the Interceptor, and he's spitting gas into the air intake. I don't know what that's called. I don't know anything about cars.
And Max yells at him. He said, hey, that's mine.
That's mine, right? And Max, just like the rest of them, he's about property. He's about the things that he owns. But yeah, so that, and then it becomes a competition between Slit and Nux and then Slit and Max to see who could spit more gas right into the air intake of like the big mega engines of these things. And during that sequence, while I was putting back Sherry, I felt some kinship with those characters, Jamie. It was like an actual connection that I had where I was like, yeah, I want to just climb up on the hood of my fucking four-cylinder RAV4 and spit wine in it somehow. And that will make my car go faster. So anyway, that is my synesthetic connection between wine and movie. I'm not saying I want to spit the wine out, but I'm saying I felt a kinship with those characters while they were chugging fortified wine and then spitting it into their engines to go fast.
I just think the wine makes me feel like, you know, all the dried fruits and the like, it just makes me feel like it's the desert. Maybe I can't put some of a finer synesthetic point on it, but it felt right for this movie. As I was watching, I was very much enjoying the interplay. And that's really all I got.
Well, and then also just, you know, your classic Jamie pairing where it's all conceptual, right? And like,
oh,
the
yeah,
first thing there I said that, to you is that, like, yeah, this movie took forever to age or forever to be made. There was this lengthy, torturous development hell cycle, and that seems to find very nice parallel with the 38 butts of the Solera.
Which take a long time to age, yes, correct.
I think it's a good pairing. I can't entirely explain it.
I'm with you there. I cannot 100% explain it. It feels right.
Well, hopefully, I was going to say, hopefully friends of the show, the Hafingtons, who have been very supportive and playing along and drinking all the wines of the last, I think, two miniseries now, but who got like half a glass into their bottle of Inothete Fino before just giving up and dumping it because it was not their bag. I was going to say, hopefully they'll maybe have a better experience this time, but I just don't think they bought the sherry at all.
I don't think so either. And they would, they had such a visceral reaction to that wine. Like,
they had the same reaction that I had, except I had to talk about it with a microphone in front of me, so I continued to drink it, whereas they were able to nope right the fuck out of that one.
Yeah, that's fair.
Oh, good for them. Jamie, for the people out there who, let's say, did enjoy this particular sherry, what do you give them for a second pour if they want to go further down that rabbit hole?
So I talked a little bit about the sweet wines of the region, and so I went in that direction. You know, we've done Fino, we've done Oloroso. I think now would be a good time if you are, you know, looking to try something that's from the region that's maybe a little bit easier to get with. The sweet wines of the region. So Pedro Ximenez is the name of a grape. It is typically used to make lusciously sweet wines. One of my favorite producers of Pedro Ximenez, or as we say in the wine trade, PX, is Bodegas Toro Albala. Their wines are from a little bit north and east of Jerez in Montilla Moriles. They tend to hold back their wines a crazy long time. And I've poured some very old wines from them that actually look like unrefined oil. Like, they pour black.
Ew.
But they're lusciously sweet.
Ew.
They're super nutty and complex. And I have yet to meet a person that has not loved these wines.
Jamie, you met me many years ago, and I'm going to just predict it right here. I don't want to, you know, decide ahead of time that I'm not going to like a thing. But the wine that you compare to crude oil is the wine that I am not going to enjoy.
You're going to love it. You're absolutely going to love it.
The one that looks like unrefined oil? Black wine?
It's black. It's crazy. The color on it is insane.
Oh, it sounds so weird and gross.
Yeah, but the thing itself tastes like roasted walnuts and pecans and stewed dried prunes and apricots and like a baked fruit cake and cinnamon and vanilla. It's just lovely.
Weird. So weird. Where can I get that? Is it inexpensive?
It's available, but it's not like super duper widely available. So you can get a bottle from the Wine Wave located in Florida of the 1994 Toro Albala for $60.
And that we feel is a reasonable price.
Yeah, this is like super sticky sweet stuff. Like this is for the end of a meal. Like if you had 10 people together all having dessert, one bottle would cover that course for all 10 people.
Well, I'm not going to say I'm going to trust you on this, but I'm going to stop questioning you on this because this just sounds, oh man. All right. Yet another.
I'll get some and I'll open it for you.
Good. It's even better. Good.
So Scotty, too hottie. What's your double feature for this movie? If you want to dig in, if you want to change it up, maybe you want a different George Miller.
Yeah, people should stick with George Miller for no other reason than nobody does sequels like George Miller, which is like to completely reinvent the thing that happened the first time and to like retain the core essence of it and then make something radically different. So I talked in the last episode a lot about how each Mad Max movie has been this like radical reinvention of the one before. So for my double feature, I'm telling people to watch one of my favorite and one of the gonzoist and craziest movies I've ever seen. Babe 2, Pig in the City. Jamie, this have you insane. Seen?
Yes,
you,
I've seen
Babe 2, Pig in the City.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is a sequel to Babe that George Miller co-wrote and was a very hands-on producer and then decided he wanted to actually direct the sequel, which he went full George Miller on. And it's big and it's weird and it only like tangentially resembles the first movie, and it has Babe loosed in the city, this like unnamed city that has all the major landmarks of every city in the world. And
it's like the Matrix city.
It is like the Matrix city. Yeah. But he and Mrs. Hoggett, the wife of the James Cromwell character from the first movie, are loosed in the city, in a city that has no room and no love for animals. And Babe finds himself being like almost like a benevolent Immortan Joe figure to a group of like abandoned animals who live alone in this strange hotel. And he has weird, mysterious adventures, and it is delightful and zany and bizarre and shockingly odd. And I, as far as a children's film goes, it is incredibly provocative in the imagery and the ideas that are going on. So Babe 2, Pig in the City, watch it, enjoy it, love it, share it with your children. It's so weird.
It's been more than a decade since I've seen this movie, and I've been meaning to rewatch it in the last year, and it just hasn't happened.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's going to happen soon.
Okay. I'm just thinking about the whole finale sequence when all of these animals are like loose in like a fancy ballroom, and poor Mrs. Hoggett is like strapped into clown pants, but the super stretchy elastic suspenders that she has on somehow get suspended from the ceiling. And so she's like doing bungee flips over this ballroom, trying to capture the pig from the chef who wants to eat him. God, it's so strange. It's so good.
Babe 2, Pig in the City.
Pig okay. in the City. Great sequel.
We've also got a new review.
We do. We have a review. People like us. They say nice things about us on internet.
Every now and then they do the nice thing and they say good things about us. S2H, would you care to read this one?
Wait, is that what that is? S2H is me? That's terrible. That's not That's intuitive. You. People are not going to understand that, and it's not funny. I don't like
S2H,
it.
S2H, Scotty Too Hottie.
That's so, so bad. You realize that my initials on their own are SH, so you put the two in. You are really bad at this. You could never be a Fury Road warlord because you're terrible at branding, Jamie.
For the record, Adrian came up with that one, not me.
Well, she's dead to me now. No, she's good. I like her, but she could do better. This latest review that we have was left for us on castbox.fm, which is one of the, I don't know, 10 million podcatchers that are out there. So thank you, castbox.fm.
Yeah, we are on roughly 70,000 different podcatchers. I
mean, literally everywhere that you could get a podcast. And this review was left for us by sister-in-law of the show, Monica Thompson, my sister-in-law. So thank you so much, Monica. So she writes, whether you're in the mood for a night with a newfound wine or a well-deserved time out to see a highly recommended movie, you will find this podcast relatable, humorous, and thought-provoking. Their approach of mixing friendly banter, logic, and reflection when comparing both their visual and physical taste keep you engaged throughout the podcast. Both sides of the spectrum prove to be valid, and both film and movie interpretations evoke emotions needed for a great debate. I agree with all of that. Thank you very much, Monica. If you, like Monica, enjoy this show and, you know, have access to internet, please go forth. Leave us a review on any of the places where reviews can be left, but especially on Apple Podcasts, which is pretty important for shows to find new audiences. You leave us a review, we will read it on an upcoming episode.
Monica was far too nice. We are not nearly as good as she makes us out to be.
No, and also I actually don't agree with her. Both sides of the spectrum do not prove valid. You are frequently invalid, Jamie.
You are an invalid, Scott.
Oh, that was a good one. That was a nice little play on words there. That was good. I am a borderline invalid. I'm almost a shut-in, actually. Well, we have come to the end, Jamie, of the end of the world as we know it, and I want wine. We have wrapped things up. Do you think we've said anything? Do you think we've made any conclusive statements about the end of the world and also tangentially what wines one might drink while riding shiny and chrome to Valhalla?
I think the very most that we've done is dumped our anxieties onto unsuspecting other people.
Well, we have done that, but I would be okay with that if it meant that I didn't still have those anxieties, and I do. So I guess it's really like sharing instead of dumping.
That's right. Misery loves company, Scott.
That is right. Well, Jamie, we're going in another direction soon, right? We have a new miniseries starting next week. Do you want to tell people you're kind of steering the ship a little bit here? We're going in a different direction.
We're going in a whole different direction. So this miniseries is going to be a little buck wild. We had sort of almost gotten into a routine where Scott would steer the ship for one miniseries and then I would steer the ship for another. And it was a sort of back and forth thing. And I had the idea of doing a miniseries on the many faces of Pinot Grigio.
Pinot Grigio!
I think it is a misunderstood grape. I think it is only understood as sort of the alcohol water that is Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio, and it can be so many things. And I was excited, or am excited, to explore the many different faces that it can present. And as I described all of these Pinot Grigios that I selected to Scott, we were in the midst of sort of both of our obsession with Matrix Resurrections.
That's right. And I could not hear anything that Jamie was saying without thinking about Lana Wachowski's 2021, I think, all-time great piece of pop culture deconstruction, The Matrix Resurrections. And so in a truly and profoundly bit of codependent self-indulgence, Jamie will spend the next six episodes talking about one grape. And I, and by extent, Jamie, will spend the next six episodes talking about The Matrix Resurrections. We're going to dive deep on two things. And I think we both agree that these are two things that maybe don't have the reputations that they deserve.
Correct.
Yeah, and we'll get into it next time. But yeah, so Jamie, what's the first bottle on deck?
The first bottle on deck is a landmark producer, as many of them are, that I spotlight on this show. This is Schioppetto Pinot Grigio from the Collio region of Friuli in Italy. That's northeast Italy, like right along the Slovenian border. We'll get into it in the next episode, but I have a lot of love for this wine and its sort of unabashed bitterness and texture. It's a lovely, lovely bit of grape juice every vintage.
Whew, all right. Well, we're getting into it, y'all. This is going to be weird. Never let yourself get comfortable with your own pet project that no one is paying you to do and not very many people are listening to. Always push yourself into new and strange places.
Yeah, we're excited just to get weird with it and talk about The Matrix.
And talk about The Matrix. Jamie and I, you're going to watch it for your fourth time tonight. I'm watching it for
this will be the fifth.
Oh, this is fifth. Your fifth, and this will be my fourth and a half time watching it.
I'm honestly very excited and a little bit embarrassed.
I'm not embarrassed. I am a little worried that after two episodes, we're going to run out of steam in a bad way. But we shall see. I'm looking forward to kind of using the movie as a jumping off point to talk about a lot of things more broadly. The reason that we're doing this is that, at least on the movie side of things, is that I think there's so fucking much that you can unpack from The Matrix Resurrections. And like I was like, well, you could do a whole, people are going to write books about this movie. Well, people are also going to do entire miniseries of podcasts about it. And why not be the first one to do that? That's also about Pinot Grigio.
This is now a podcast about Pinot Grigio and the Matrix Resurrections.
For the next six episodes, we are exclusively talking about Pinot Grigio and the Mayfortrix. Wow, that's way easier for me to text that to people than to say it out loud.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate.
It's true.
All right, Jamie, take us home. Take us home.
We're going home. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. It was and always is a pleasure. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us with any complaints, comments, constructive criticisms, or just ranting and raving at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to tell your friends.
Tell your friends, then they'll be our friends. This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That is me. And our social media presence is thanks to Jamie Rubin. That is him right over there. I'm pointing at a bookshelf because Jamie and I are on Zoom once again.
Back in the goddamn bunker.
Never left, Jamie.
Everyone, especially when you're in the bunker, remember to drink more wine and watch more movies. It will give you the illusion of actually living a life. We promise.
That was fucking bleak, man. I don't even have anything to add on to that. That's fucking bleak. Jesus. Oh. Oh. Fuck. All right, goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye. We love you.
Enjoy Pinot Grigio and the Matrix. See everybody back here next week. Goodbye.